Well, good evening again. As we've been going through the Book of Lamentations and asking, what do we do with grief? How do we handle when we have something to mourn? What does it mean to lament? We've seen our narrator, the writer of Lamentations, change over time. He began, frankly, a little bit histrionic, with lines like, "Oh, there's never ever been suffering like mine. It's never been this bad," which of course we all just kind of rolled our eyes at, because of course there has. That's nonsense. But over time, he's become more aware of himself, I think. He's become more rooted in what's actually happened to him, as opposed to just making noise. And here we get to a point where he's able to actually express hope from within the pain. Now, this isn't necessarily a prescription, like, you know, follow things in this order, start by going off the rails and exaggerating your pain, and then eventually you'll get to this point. Please don't do that. But it's more of like an invitation and an example. And today in this passage, he's speaking from a point of immense grief. I mean, everybody he knew was killed in front of him if they were lucky. Everything was had burned around him. His beloved city was destroyed. And so as he's speaking from that woundedness, he starts expressing something different, a little bit of hope. But it's a different kind of hope, as we're going to see. There's a proverb from, you know, Proverbs, "Don't sing songs to a heavy heart," which is incredibly wise. In other words, when somebody is in that moment of grief, don't try to cheer them up by telling them a joke. It's just going to make things worse. And that should be intuitive for all of us. Think of a really bad day, a tragic day. And then you come home and the last thing you want to do is watch a stand-up comedian. It would just kind of rub you the wrong way. I would add to that a corollary. Not that I'm adding to the Bible. That's not cool. But I would add to that, when somebody with a heavy heart sings, pay attention, because it probably is very meaningful. Especially if they're speaking from that point of grief. Because then not only are they expressing what they're actually feeling and what's actually going on rather than just making noise, but it means that they're also starting to come to terms with it, starting to work it through. And maybe not figure out what it means, because we're never guaranteed to know what any of that means. But maybe they can start to see it in a slightly bigger picture, because grief, tragedy, will have a tendency to narrow our vision. And so here he addresses God in some incredibly important ways. As you'll see in verse 22, he says, "Because of the Lord's faithful love, we do not perish, for his mercies never end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will put my hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him. To the person who seeks him, it is good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord." Notice that those words are filled with hope, and acknowledging characteristics or character attributes of God that we would all find to be some of the most important attributes of God ever described. At no point does our narrator say, "Therefore, I know he's going to get me out of this." It's kind of a famous-ish line from We're talking ancient history now, from the way back to the 1990s. And I don't even remember which episode it was. It was an episode of The Simpsons, you know, where you find really good theology. And Homer Simpson, you know, America's dad, is in a really tight spot. And so he prays. And he says, "I don't know if you're real, and I don't know if what they say about you is true. But Superman, if you can get me out of this, I would be grateful." There's actually a lot of depth in that statement, just not where you'd expect to find it. Because usually when we say, in those moments when we feel a tremendous need, for whatever reason, it's not uncommon for us to talk about trust. Like, I trust that God will see me through. I trust that this will happen. And we are guaranteed none of that. I'm very open that with the fact that if somebody were to ask me without any context, "Do you trust God?" My answer is just immediately no. And I answer it that way because when we usually talk about trusting God, it means that we trust God for an outcome that we have in mind. That the idea that we can trust God, but what that really means is I'm going to be okay in the end. In which case, I want to really, really want to know what you mean by "we'll be okay." Or, "I trust that, you know, I'll find new employment if you've lost your job. I trust that this relationship that seems to be falling apart, that it's we're going to find a way back together." Maybe, maybe not. The hard reality is that we don't ever know what God is really ultimately up to. And we won't until we can look at it in retrospect. And yet, our narrator of Lamentations expresses a significant amount of trust in God, but it's not for an outcome. This is the sign that somebody has let go of the illusion of control over suffering. I know, like, in my own life, especially early on when, you know, it was originally diagnosed with leukemia and it felt like the world was collapsing around me. So cue the histrionics and all of that. Probably early on we would say, and some of my family would say, he's going to be okay. We trust God that he's going to be okay. And then there came a point where I realized, like, yeah, but what if I'm not? We don't have that guarantee, do we? And I know for me, that was the moment when I realized that there's so much going on here that I have no control over. And it just makes things worse if I cling to that illusion. Now, I know if it's not apparent, in my case, I was okay. Because I am still here. And so the question then for tonight is, as we think about what it means to express hope from the woundedness, how is our narrator talking about God in a way that's both meaningful and takes his grief and his trauma seriously, while also not putting his own expectations of who God is and what God should do and be? That is, try to maintain the illusion of control. And I think it has to do, at least in some part, with this idea of God's faithfulness or faithful love. This translation says faithful love. That's a very, very big, important, weighty word in the Hebrew Bible. In Hebrew, it's chesed. You might have heard of it if you stick around long enough. It's a word that Christians will sometimes come across. And sometimes it's translated love. Sometimes it's, if you're being really fancy and you're trying to impress academic people, you would say covenant fidelity, whatever that means. or God's tendency to be faithful to the promises that he's made, his unending love, his enduring love, his patient love. All of those meanings kind of get funneled into this one word, and it kind of means, it's a rare situation, but it kind of means all of those things at the same time. And it's a word that is expressed in moments of hope and expectation, but all it really does is label a characteristic of God without saying, therefore, these things will be okay. And in fact, in the context of Lamentations chapter 3, things are decidedly not okay, and they frankly won't be okay. Not for his generation, at least. And yet, he creates this tension that I think we all will eventually learn to live in, if we haven't already. That sometimes life can be on fire and falling apart around us, and at the same time, God is still good. And he is still faithful. And he still gives us his mercy every day. And rather than bring those two tensions together, I think part of what it means to just grow as a disciple of Jesus is to learn to hold those two tensions together, because they're true at the same time. I think part of the genius of the book of Lamentations, other than the fact that it's entirely an acrostic poem, multiple acrostic poems, which I haven't mentioned yet, which is really good for me, but I have to now. If you open your Bible to Lamentations, you'll see different Hebrew letters, and it's because stanzas start with the next letter in the alphabet, and it repeats that over and over. It's very carefully written. And you can maybe feel some of that genius in the way it's organized, but you can definitely by this point. Because he's come to this moment where he realizes that even if nothing changes, God is still God. He is faithful. His mercies are new every morning, whatever that's going to look like. And maybe wisdom is found in letting go of control. If you can manage that tension, then you can mature as a follower of Jesus and just as a human being, which is kind of the point anyway. One of my mentors in college, he was a pastor, told this story that it bears repeating as often as possible because it's so ridiculous. His roommate forgot that he had an exam. And being somebody who's trying to be a faithful Jesus follower, he panicked and then went to take the exam. And he was telling my friend Kyle that he was going to pray and he was going to ask God for all of the answers. It was a multiple choice test. Bold move. And he would encounter the question, he'd pray, and he'd see, I feel like God's saying that's a D or a C or whatever. So eventually he's telling this to my mentor, and he says, and wouldn't you know it, I got an 86. And they were like, wow, all right, that's awesome. God is good. Until my friend reflected on that some years later. And said, hold on, I think God can do better than an 86. Which is not wrong. But then also, what would God want in that situation? To give him the answers, or to learn his lesson and become a better student? Obviously that second one. That as we learn more and experience more about the character of God And in this case, our writer is just narrowing in on his faithful covenantal loyalty and faithfulness. That it should provoke, even in the most painful, dark moments, it should provoke that sense of depth and growth and maturity. Because ultimately, of course, that's what God would want for our lives. Now, there's also embedded in this, in actually some of the language that he uses, that spreads throughout the biblical narrative in some ways that we absolutely do not have time to dig into tonight. It would literally take hours. But that I think the writer of Lamentations is keying into that will then take place, readers of the Bible places that he had no idea and would absolutely blow his mind. Because you see the Apostle Paul, for example, as he's trying to, in his writing, explain just how big of a deal Jesus being sent to us really is. And he will tap into some of that. Only he'll do it in a way that reflects generations of thought and prayer and linguistic and language evolution. Because there's a way to talk about God's faithfulness in an ancient Hebrew mindset that then gets kind of placed in the New Testament. And we would describe it in the New Testament, at least Paul does, as God's righteousness. And here's why that's important. We usually think of the righteousness of God as his quality of being right. Or we would use that word righteous as a way to make fun of somebody. Like, oh, look at that person. They're very righteous, which is code for stay away from them. They're obnoxious because they're, you know, being righteous everywhere. But when Paul talks about the righteousness of God, it is a callback to some of the same language that our writer in Lamentations uses. And for generations, it has meant to God's people as they've endured horrific things, that God is still faithful. His mercies still rise with the sun. No, I don't know how that's going to turn out. No, I don't know what it means. No, this does not mean that God has any interest in rescuing us from our suffering. Because have you noticed? He doesn't. And yet, it becomes this almost code for growth and a call to faithfulness on our part. So as we look then at these tensions of God is faithful and his love is unending, he also has no interest in rescuing us or just making everything nice again or easy again. How many times have we prayed, God, can you just fix this situation? Can you just fix this relationship? It's falling apart. Can you fix that person because they're driving me crazy? Pastors pray that one a lot. That's half true, half true. Or God, can you fix the economy? God, can you find me a new job? God, can you take the cancer away from me? Can you make me feel better? God typically isn't interested. That doesn't mean he never heals, because sometimes he does. Why? I have no idea. However, if both of those things are true, and as the Apostle Paul is writing, looking at the whole history, very tragic history of his people, only to see this moment where God's final, full, ultimate plan has been unfurled like a scroll, Namely, that God had the audacity to send his son Jesus as a human into our world to redeem the world, to save the very people that are going to put him to death. Paul, especially in the book of Galatians and Romans, will say, that is the righteousness of God. He has been faithful in a way that we never thought possible. Faithful in a way that we really didn't see coming. And is so far beyond what we anticipated that this has to change the world, and it did. At the moment Jesus hits the ground, Paul sees the story of God in its entirety. And rather than a story of escape, a story of just God coming down and patting us on our heads and making everything bad go away, instead, he chooses to redeem it. And you can't redeem long suffering like that by pretending it isn't there or making it go away. You redeem it by enduring it. That's what it means to speak words of hope from a place of woundedness. And so over the next 2 weeks, we will finish a brief discussion of what it means to lament. As you are able, I invite you to rise.